Welcome to the debate. Imagine a biological organism that has evolved a really brilliantly effective, but ultimately doomed mechanism for survival.
Okay.
Whenever a part of its body is injured, instead of, expending energy to send healing resources to that area, the brain simply turns off the pain receptors.
Wow, that is a pretty chilling image.
Right? The wound continues to fester, the tissue degrades, but the brain's internal dashboard registers everything as perfectly fine.
So the organism achieves this sense of internal coherence, a feeling of perfect health, entirely by refusing to perceive its own tissue necrosis.
Exactly.
It survives the immediate moment, but only by sacrificing its long-term viability.
Yeah, the system is technically functioning, but it is fundamentally disconnected from the reality of its own decline. And that central metaphor brings us to our topic of discourse today. We're looking at Dr. Bechara Sali's transdisciplinary white paper, Letting the Wound Update the Model.
Right.
This work asks us to take Karl Friston's free energy principle, which is a neurobiological concept explaining how living systems minimize uncertainty, and we'll apply it to the geopolitical and institutional scale.
And it forces us to confront a very specific and frankly deeply unsettling central question. Can a biological and cognitive theory of self-evidencing be successfully adapted into a normative ethical framework for institutional self-correction?
Yeah, that's the core of it.
Where does the inherent nature of systemic self-preservation make this idea of life-coherent geopolitics an unworkable paradox?
Well, I take the position that Sahali's framework is a brilliant and necessary diagnostic tool, demonstrating that institutions can and must be designed to be corrigible by life, by letting the evidence of harm actually update their operational models.
And I contend that while it's morally compelling, mapping biological active inference onto state power reveals a fatal contradiction. The very mechanisms of institutional survival fundamentally rely on externalizing harm and hardening boundaries, making true life-coherent self-evidencing geopolitically unstable.
So, to really ground this discourse, we need to unpack Karl Friston's free energy principle. Because if you're listening to this, you might be wondering what neurobiology has to do with global politics.
Fair point.
At its core, Friston's principle dictates that self-organizing systems, whether we're talking about a single cell or a human brain, persist by minimizing surprise or uncertainty. They don't just passively observe the world.
They operate through what is called a generative model, right?
Exactly. Think of it as a deeply ingrained map, like a probabilistic understanding of what kind of world the organism expects to inhabit.
Right, and they engage in a process Friston calls self-evidencing. They act and perceive in ways that maximize the evidence that their map of reality is correct. If your brain's model expects your body temperature to be 98.6 degrees and you walk into a freezing room, you experience a massive prediction error.
You feel cold.
Right, you minimize that uncertainty by putting on a coat. You take action to make reality match your model.
Spot on. And what Sahali does so effectively is bridge this concept from individual brains to social institutions, using the idea of regimes of expectation.
Meaning institutions have models too.
Yes, a government, a legal system, or a market expects the world to behave a certain way. But Sahali points out a crucial gap when we apply this to politics. An institutional system can self-evidence by learning and repairing. Sahali calls this life-coherent self-evidencing.
Where the wound updates the model.
Right. Say a community suffering from lack of clean water becomes high-priority evidence that forces the state to correct its model.
But there is an alternative.
Exactly. The alternative is pathological self-evidencing. This is where the institution preserves its own model by suppressing or entirely discounting the evidence of harm. It turns off the pain receptors.
It ignores the wound.
Yeah. To show what life coherence looks like in practice, the white paper looks at citizenship by investment, or CBI programs, specifically in the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States.
The passport sales.
Right. Historically, selling passports has been heavily constrained by the demands of global finance. It treats sovereignty merely as a commodified mobility asset for wealthy elites. But Sahali shows how these states can flip the script.
By changing where the money goes.
Exactly. By legally binding the revenue from these CBI programs to what he calls life capacity outcomes. We're talking tangible things like water security, public health infrastructure, renewable energy.
Okay.
The state's model shifts. The system sustains itself not by satisfying foreign capital, but by enlarging the actual conditions of life for its people.
Okay, I'll admit, applying neurobiology to Caribbean economic policy sounds incredibly elegant on paper. The idea of tying sovereignty to biological thriving is a beautiful vision.
But?
But practically speaking, I struggle to buy the normative leap he's making here. Let's look at how biology actually works.
Sure.
In biological active inference, lowering the importance what the theory calls the precision of disruptive external signals is exactly how biological entities maintain their system boundaries. The technical term is a Markov blanket.
Right. We should probably clarify that. A Markov blanket is essentially a statistical boundary. It's like the cell wall that separates the inside of an organism from the outside world.
Exactly. A cell must selectively exclude its environment to exist at all. If a cell lets everything in, it dissolves. It dies.
Mm-hmm.
Positing that this mechanism of exclusion somehow becomes pathological the moment we scale it up to the institutional level completely ignores the reality of state survival. Autopoiesis, the drive to self-create and self-maintain, is brutal.
So you think states have to exclude?
I do. Let's look at the Chagos Archipelago. For decades, the strategic security model of the United States and the United Kingdom has treated the military base on Diego Garcia as absolutely indispensable to Western security.
Right.
Now, that security model structurally requires the displacement and exile of the native Chagosians. The military base cannot exist as a secure, isolated black site if a local civilian population is living right next to the runway.
So the displacement is a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. It isn't a glitch in their generative model. It is the foundation of it. A state's self-maintenance almost structurally demands taking its own internal uncertainty and externalizing it onto someone else.
I see.
Asking a geopolitical entity to prioritize universal life capacity over its own strategic survival threatens its very coherence. The theory is asking states to behave in a way that biology itself does not permit.
Well, I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Because I think the concept of precision distortion is where we find the leverage to fix this.
Okay, explain.
How does a bureaucracy actually turn a blind eye to a sacrifice zone like Chagos? It does it through precision weighting. Power dictates what counts as loud, high-precision evidence and what counts as ignorable noise.
Right, the dashboard.
Yeah. To a powerful institution, a military spokesperson is deemed credible by default. Their statements are high-precision signals that immediately update the system's dashboard. Orders maintained. Security is achieved.
While the victims are ignored.
Precisely. A civilian witness or an indigenous community suffering from exile is treated as low-precision noise. The system is literally programmed not to compute their data.
Because computing it would mean the system has to change its entire architecture.
Exactly. But the result is that the marginalized must exhaust themselves trying to prove they are even experiencing harm before their testimony is registered.
Yeah.
Sahu isn't saying that boundaries shouldn't exist. He is advocating for a precision reversal. He argues we must actively protect the ecology of evidence, the journalists, the doctors, the whistleblowers.
The sensory organs of society.
Right. A life-coherent system amplifies the pain signal instead of muting it.
I come at it from a different way. You're framing this filtering mechanism as an institutional bad habit, like a glitch that can be corrected if we just tweak the policy and protect the journalists.
It is a fixable pathology, yes.
But if we look at the reality in Palestine and Gaza, particularly since October 2023, we see that precision distortion isn't a glitch. It is complete narrative capture.
Okay.
The media systems and security priors inherently assigned low precision to Palestinian testimony by design. Let me explain how this mechanism functions on the ground.
Go ahead.
Take the specific example highlighted in Francesca Albanese's interview discussed in the analysis. Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, a respected physician and hospital director, is detained by military forces.
Right, a literal medical sensory organ?
Immediately cast as a suspect. The destroyed hospital is cast as a disputed combat site.
and the dead child becomes a tragic but inevitable collateral statistic.
Precisely. The reality gets rewritten to protect the model. Dominant powers inevitably use this narrative capture to protect their self-image of innocence.
Because admitting it breaks their self-image.
Yes. A system that fundamentally sees itself as a righteous democracy simply cannot integrate the evidence that it practices domination. If it accepted that evidence, its generative model would collapse.
Wow. So...
therefore, the sensory organs aren't just accidentally ignored. They are actively sanctioned and neutralized. The state lowers the precision of the wound because feeling the wound would destroy the state's identity.
Well, that is a deeply cynical view of institutional capacity, though, I mean, I admit, not unfounded, but consider the autoimmune disease analogy.
Okay.
If a biological system systematically ignores or attacks its own pain receptors, the doctors, the witnesses, the aid workers, it eventually destroys itself.
Right.
It is exactly as Saheli notes. If truth requires martyrdom, the system is poorly designed. Yes, the self-image of innocence is powerful, and the legal media collapse we see in Gaza is a profound example of pathological self-evidencing.
A total collapse.
But Saheli warns that systems that cannot learn from life harm will inevitably be corrected by breakdown. He calls it collapse by delayed correction.
The reality catches up.
Yes. Think about the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion, finding the continued presence in the occupied territory unlawful. In Frestonian terms, that ruling is a massive legal prediction error introduced into the global system.
And the system tries to ignore it.
But if the dominant powers continue to lower the precision of that legal and living evidence, they aren't just harming others. They are risking their own total institutional and moral necrosis. The rules-based order dissolves.
But let's move from the diagnostic theory to the practical architecture proposed to prevent this necrosis. Because this is where the timeline of state survival really clashes with the timeline of biology.
You mean the lifetime triggers?
Exactly. The framework introduces this concept of lifetime triggers. The idea is that institutions must abandon slow, bureaucratic, procedural time and instead respond to the urgent biological time of hunger, illness, or ecological tipping points.
Right. A government committee debating for 10 years doesn't help a river that is currently drying up.
I agree entirely. But look at the critical minerals paradox. The entire world must decarbonize. We can all agree that is the preferred necessary planetary state to minimize future climate uncertainty.
Of course.
But the mechanism of this green transition treats mineral supply, like the massive demand for cobalt and lithium from the Democratic Republic of Congo, as a mere technical bottleneck.
Treating it as a math problem, not a biological one.
Right. And in doing so, the global system reproduces massive extraction, child labor, water depletion, and localized sacrifice zones.
Yeah.
So my question is, how can an urgent planetary goal operate on lifetime when its immediate free energy reduction, its very survival, requires dominating and extracting from a localized area?
I see your point.
By framing mining quotas as urgent national security and climate metrics, the global North bureaucracy literally cannot compute the localized ecological damage. The software isn't built to read the suffering of the extraction zone. The global system lowers the uncertainty of its climate future by exponentially increasing the uncertainty and suffering of the Congo.
Well, I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because it assumes that top-down management and resource domination are the only ways a system can achieve a goal.
How else do you build millions of batteries?
To explain why this doesn't have to be the case, we need to bring in a term Saheli uses from philosopher John McMurtry, life value onto axiology.
Okay, let's translate that for the audience.
Fair enough. It's a dense term, but the underlying mechanism is actually quite simple. It asks, what is the fundamental metric of value in your society? Are you reading a financial dashboard or a biological dashboard?
Okay.
A green transition that poisons a river or relies on child labor is operating on the financial dashboard. It is treating the transition as an extractive project, which is a pathological model.
So how do you fix the model?
To be genuinely life coherent, the architecture must convert management into repair. The argument is that we must utilize independent correction loops, participatory model revision, and strict ecological safeguards. You cannot simply manage the suffering of the extraction zone while leaving the structural causes intact.
But that takes time.
If the climate-vulnerable communities in the global south are left waiting on endless procedural time, waiting for theoretical climate finance that never arrives because it's blocked by debt discipline and investor confidence, the model is failing.
the system's dashboard must be forced to register biological lifetime.
That sounds ideal. Truly, it does. But let's test that against the concept of the Markov blanket we discussed earlier, the hard boundaries that define a system.
Sure.
That's a compelling argument for reform, but have you considered how this plays out under conditions of existential threat? Take the case of Cuba.
Okay.
Cuba and the United States are locked in a mutually reinforcing inferential trap. They are looking at the exact same data and using it to reinforce two entirely different maps of reality.
The data being the severe economic deprivation on the island.
Right. The blackouts, the fuel shortages, the collapse of public transportation. To the U.S. generative model, this deprivation is high-precision evidence of communist failure. It perfectly justifies the continuation of coercive pressure and the embargo.
And the flip side.
Meanwhile, the Cuban state looks at that exact same scarcity and registers it as high-precision evidence of imperial aggression. That interpretation demands revolutionary vigilance, which then allows internal dissent to be framed not as organic feedback, but as externally induced sabotage.
So both sides are perfectly self-evidencing.
Exactly. And when a system is under literal siege, a semi-permeable boundary, the truth, is a luxury it feels it can't afford. Hardening the boundary, regulating reality so the governing model doesn't have to change, is the only way a constrained society prevents total collapse.
So they can't let the wound speak.
If you are under embargo, letting the wound update the model might mean letting the state dissolve entirely.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame the solution differently. True sovereignty isn't merely defiance or border anxiety or enduring a permanent siege.
What is it then?
If a state survives but its people cannot thrive, what has actually been preserved? Sahali argues that sovereignty must be measured by life capacity, the literal physical ability of living beings to breathe, eat, participate in their communities, and heal.
Okay.
The analysis proposes a dual corrective for this exact inferential trap with Cuba. First, yes, the external life support strangulation from the U.S. embargo must end. That is a biological prerequisite.
Right.
But crucially, it must be paired with internal civic opening, energy decentralization, and the protection of domestic dissent. Dissent has to be treated as corrective feedback, not betrayal. Sovereignty must be preserved through repair, not through denial.
But the state still has to defend itself.
Yes, but if the Cuban citizen is reduced to either a victim of the regime by one side or a counter-revolutionary by the other, the living subject entirely disappears into the administrative object. They become a political abstraction rather than a human being requiring life capacity.
And yet, returning to the broader diagnostic grammar, we see this phenomenon of externalizing harm everywhere, independent of ideology. Look at Western Sahara, where international trade and resource development proceed without the consent of the indigenous Sahrawi people.
Yeah.
The pathological model of the occupying forces says that economic stability justifies proceeding. The dashboard treats development as success while entirely downweighting the right to self-determination. Or, to bring it closer to home for many, look at Mediterranean migration.
Oh, a devastating example of the dashboard ignoring the biological reality.
Exactly. European border systems assign incredibly high precision to deterrence. The goal is reducing the number of physical arrivals on European shores.
Right.
Conversely, the system assigns shockingly low precision to the deaths, the pushbacks, and the disappearances of migrants along the route. How does a bureaucracy turn a blind eye? By defining success entirely by the border.
If arrivals drop, the dashboard flashes green.
Yes, order is restored. The system perfectly self-evidences its border control model while externalizing the lethal consequences beyond its horizon of public concern. It is autopoiesis, working exactly as designed. The state survives by letting the wound occur outside its Markov blanket.
Which is precisely why Sahali's framework is so vital right now. It provides us with the vocabulary to point at that dashboard and say, this is not success. This is profound pathology.
It gives us the words.
Exactly. It asks the critical, uncomfortable question, what is the system unable to apologize for, repair, or remember truthfully?
Right.
As we conclude our discourse today, my position remains that this diagnostic grammar is essential. We have to move our civilization away from relying on heroic witnesses, where speaking the truth about structural violence requires incredible bravery and often martyrdom, and toward designed corrigibility.
Built-in repair.
Right. Institutions must be architected at their core to adapt to the living evidence they harm. They must make the wound the ultimate teacher. Because if they continue to act as self-sealing models, treating human and ecological suffering as external noise to be filtered out, they will ultimately face catastrophic breakdown. You cannot ignore the necrosis forever.
And as we close, I maintain that while life coherence offers a profound and necessary analytical lens to identify structural violence, the attempt to seamlessly graft biological active inference onto geopolitics exposes a harsh reality.
Mm-hmm.
The examples we've explored, from the militarized displacement in the Chagos Archipelago to the mutually reinforcing inferential traps of besieged nations, demonstrate that institutional self-preservation intrinsically relies on minimizing internal uncertainty by dumping it onto others.
You see it as inevitable.
States are not just large, complex bodies that can be healed through therapy. They are structures of power. And structures of power survive by aggressively maintaining their preferred maps of reality, regardless of the biological cost.
Well, despite our different interpretations of the structural limits of state power, it is clear we share a strong area of convergence today.
Definitely.
So Hilly's diagnostic grammar, the simple but radical act of asking a system what it is pathologically conserving, whose suffering it mutes, and what it would have to become if it actually let the wound update its model, is a remarkably incisive tool for analyzing power in the 21st century.
I agree entirely. The framework cuts right through the usual ideological noise. It forces us to look at the mechanics of state behavior. And there is far more to explore in this white paper's specific case matrix.
Oh, absolutely.
For instance, the insights into the emergency response rooms in Sudan, where citizens are building legitimacy from the ground up, creating life coherence out of the emergency commons when the top-down state has failed them. There are glimmers of how this biological approach to repair can actually function.
Yeah. We leave it to you, the listener, to decide if our massive, complex geopolitical systems can truly learn to be corrected by the life they harm, or if systemic collapse will eventually force their hand.
Time will tell.
Think back to that organism we started with. The one perfectly content, perfectly blind to its own failing tissue. When the pain receptors are finally inevitably turned back on, will the system have the capacity to begin the hard work of repair? Or will it already be too late?